Thank you for listening to the Impact Leaders Podcast, featuring leaders in sustainable and impact investment and performance with purpose, sharing their stories, experiences, and advice to increase awareness and highlight best practices in order to help more people, institutions, and companies transition more capital into the industry faster. I am grateful that you're choosing to invest your time to listen to our guests, since I know that you're going to feel encouraged and inspired. I am JP Dalman, founder and CEO of ILM Partners, and we are the proud sponsors of the podcast. ILM Partners is an advisory and soon-to-launch multi-asset management firm targeting to acquire and scale investment funds focused on sustainability and impact, one of the fastest-growing areas of investment management globally, enabling investors to generate returns with confidence whilst having a net positive impact in the world. Our mission is to facilitate and accelerate the transition of £5 billion of capital to sustainable and impact investing in the next 5 years. If you would like to explore the opportunity of working together, email contact@ilaandpartners.com using podcast intro as reference in the subject line for an introductory and confidential conversation. Your support means everything to us, since it's what really keeps us going. So make sure you share our work with someone that will benefit from it. Please remember to subscribe to get the notifications from your preferred platform and follow us on social media to stay connected by selecting your favorite application using the links in the notes of each episode. We hope you enjoy today's special conversation. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Impact Leaders. I hope everyone is healthy and safe, and that you are finding the inspiration and actions to make the most of this new world we are living in. Today's episode of Impact Leaders is part of our new series called The Sustainable Investment Dilemma, looking into how industries can help address the climate and social crisis, in particular, the financial industry, taking on the opportunity to address the way it has financed activities that have taken us to our current situation. I invite you all to visit our sponsor's website at ilaandpartners.com and the YouTube channel to watch the first video interview on this paramount subject and launch of this series. And to begin with our first guest for this series, we have Professor Vanina Farber and Peter Whiffley. Hello.
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 Welcome, and thank you so much for being with us today. As a way of introduction, please let me share with the audience a short version of your extensive bios, just for context. Professor Vanina Farber is an economist and political scientist who specializes in social innovation, sustainable finance, entrepreneurship, and sustainability, and has almost 20 years of teaching, researching, and consultancy experience, having worked with academic institutions, multinational corporations, and international organizations. She holds a PhD in business administration, economics, and an MA in economics from the University of Memphis, as well as a licenciatura in political science from the University of Buenos Aires in Argentina. She's currently the holder of the ELEA Chair for Social Innovation at IMD, which is the International Institute for Management Development, a top-ranked business school in Lausanne, Switzerland. I'll tell you more about that in a bit. And prior to joining IMD, Vanina was an associate professor and chair of sustainable entrepreneurship and social inclusion at the University del Pacifico in Peru, where she was also the dean of the Graduate School of Business from 2014 to 2016. Welcome to Impact Leaders, Professor.
Thank you, Matt, JP. Very happy to be here.
It's an honor. And our second guest, we have, obviously, as you can tell, two guests episode today, which I actually enjoy very much, is Peter Whiffley, a PhD. Peter is a senior leader and entrepreneurial philanthropist. He's also the founder and chairman of the ELEA Foundation for Ethics in Globalization. In addition, Peter is the honorary chairman of IMD and serves on the boards of Signum, a digital asset bank in Zurich and Singapore, and of Partners Group Impact Foundation. He's also the vice chairman of the Zurich Opera House. Previously, Peter was a partner at McKinsey & Company, the CEO of UBS Group, and the chairman of Partners Group, a global leader for private markets investments, and IMD, respectively. In 1984, Peter obtained a PhD in economics from the University of St. Gallen in Switzerland, with a dissertation on Swiss direct investments in Mexico. He regularly publishes on topics related to globalization, ethics, leadership, philanthropy, and impact investing. In 2015, his book, Inclusive Leadership, A Framework for the Global Era, was published by Springer. Welcome to Impact Leaders, Peter.
Thank you very much, JP.
It's a real honor to have you both, and a pleasure. And if I may add, today we're also here to celebrate and talk about your recently published book that you wrote together. So that is very exciting. It's called The ELEA Way, A Learning Journey Towards Sustainable Impact, which was published, if I'm correct, this year, right? By Routledge.
November last year.
End of 2020.
So this is the first time that we have a recently published book on an episode, especially, you know, with the angle to impact. And we were going to be covering a lot about it, ideally, today, so that people get at least an insight into it. And they will actually be very, very happy to learn all the things that you're sharing. I'm definitely most excited to hear all about it.
Thank you.
So, as it is our tradition, our first question is, what is sustainable and impact investing?
So if you want, I can start, and Peter can follow up on this one too. When we talk about an impact investing, sometimes there's a lot of confusion about the topic and we use it in many different ways. But I think it is interesting to define it by certain features. And I think one of the key issues is intentionality. So these are investments that are intentionally decided or proactively decided to produce a certain impact, no desired impact or expected impact. And that impact has to be measured. When we talk especially about impact investing, since we have the word investing there, we also have an expectation of a return. Now, when we talk about philanthropic impact investing, as we're going to talk today, the book talks a lot about philanthropic impact investing. Sometimes you can take below market returns or play a little bit with the philanthropic piece of it and with the enterprise building. But usually the three key issues in the definition are intentionality, impact measurement, and expectation of returns. But usually you have some satellite additional features. And I think one important on philanthropic impact investing is additionality. So the idea of impact investing or philanthropic impact investing that we talk in the book is to actually operate or work in spaces where commercial capital usually doesn't go in because of a matter of risk or below market returns. So philanthropic impact investor plays a catalytic role, I would say, a de-risking role, a market building role, that if this type of investment wouldn't have been there, the impact would not happen. No. So this idea of additionality is something important, especially for philanthropic impact investors. You know, and we talk a little bit about all these features and how they play a very particular role in the case of the ELEA Foundation. And I think a key part of this, for example, in the intentionality, is that the ELEA Foundation works intentionally on fighting absolute poverty with entrepreneurial means. So if you're going to see the cases of things that we work, the ELEA Foundation works on fighting absolute poverty.
So maybe building on what Vanina said, we have seen a tremendous rise of impact investing since 2007, when this term was actually coined by a meeting of eminent people. And it was against the background of a study that was done by a large investment bank that basically said we should create a new asset class, which is called impact investing along these criteria that Vanina just elaborated. And by now we have somewhere between $500 and $700 billion of committed capital to impact investing. And so this has developed a tremendous momentum. At the same time, we have seen another big trend in this arena, which was the trend of social entrepreneurship, maybe inspired by organizations such as Ashoka or the Skoll Forum in the US or the WEF, Leaders of Tomorrow. We have seen a kind of momentum to recognize entrepreneurial qualities in the social arena, to award them, to help them, to get them plugged into networks. And so the thesis of the book basically is that these are the two building blocks. These are the two pillars that we have seen over the past 10 to 20 years. Social entrepreneurship on one hand, impact investing on the other, and these are great trends. And they form part of a movement to make capitalism more inclusive. And what is needed is to integrate these two trends to basically make sure that entrepreneurs can leverage capital and that investors have a good understanding of what impact is, that they know what Vanina just said, that it's intentional, that it's measurable, which means that it should be clearly defined, and that they ask these pertinent questions about additionality. And that's essentially what the book is about. So how to integrate entrepreneurship and capital for impact. That's the thesis of the book in one sentence.
Fantastic. And we'll come back to that. But before we move to another question, and again, Pete, you used to be the CEO at UBS Group, right?
Yes.
So, and you have effectively quite a career in the financial industry, which now I can see how it all has been, you know, coming together to do what you're doing with the foundation and with IMD. But what do you think about this question which I'm raising, which is this, you know, are we facing a sustainable investment dilemma in terms of whatever that means to you? But, and we'll talk about the conflict perhaps between profit and impact.
Yeah, I mean, my core belief is capitalism is something great, and capitalism can and should be the solution and not the problem. So in that sense, I'm a strong supporter of capitalism. But what I also say is we should transform it. We should make capitalism more inclusive. And that essentially means that the concepts that are driven by clients in the first place who want more sustainable products and services, by investors who want to invest in SRI compatible, ESG compliant investment opportunities which have impact on both social and environmental matters. Essentially also talent, and that's probably the biggest change, that talented people today, they want to work with companies that pursue meaningful purpose. They want to know why they're coming to work, and just basically increasing profit or survival is not enough for them. So we, for example, at Elea, we see tremendous demand of talented people. We had two positions last year for our talent program, and we got over 180 applications for just two positions. So I think young people particularly, they want this. And finally, the public expects capitalism to be articulated in a way that one understands how it adds to society and how it contributes to solving the great challenges that the planet faces in terms of both its environmental sustainability as well as its social sustainability. So in that sense, I don't think capitalism is the problem. I think capitalism is the solution. In many areas, market solutions are good. But capitalism needs to be inclusive. It needs to respond to expectations of primarily clients, investors, talented people, and the environment, the public at large.
Yeah, and okay. Adding a little bit on that side, I think I do believe that there is a space we used to think in terms of we do impact in the philanthropy side or in the foundation, mm-hmm. and then we make money, even if you were, for example, a business, you have the foundation or a family office to manage wealth, or you corporates make money and foundations are for impact. And we had to be used to live in kind of this dichotomous type of world. The idea is that more and more, both things are happening together. Know that you cannot have one below the other, but that takes a change in mindset. Know to understand that you can bring market tools or market solutions that are more effective to solve social environmental problems usually takes a huge change in leadership, a change in management, yeah. a change in the way we relate to nature, even. No, understanding that there are boundaries, understanding about inclusion. So I think we are talking about bringing market solutions to social environmental problems, but also changing the mindset on how we address. And I think that's the interesting part of the book, that also talk about partnerships. So it's not that those that finance and those that are social entrepreneurs have an unequal relationship. No, so we talk about partnership, we talk about collaboration, and we talk about reframing. No, and I think getting out of that dichotomous mind sometimes is difficult. No, but something that we work a lot also at IMD Business School is to train leaders to understand that you can do well by doing good. And it's a challenge because you need to be highly qualified to actually do that and not to think only short term. No.
Yes, yes. I should have disclaimed before, I'm a huge fan of UBS. I happen to have my together band, my together band, my blue one, which is partnership.
I see your SDG.
Which is the one that I personally support with my company, and I also have the SDG pin. So, but you know, it's interesting, and you will see. I have interviewed Optimus Foundation CEO in the past, Phyllis. And they are really leading. So it's interesting to see, you know, you here, Peter, as well, and the work you're doing, and bringing somebody like Vanina on board to, you know, bring these two trends and, you know, this kind of parallel worlds together.
When I was at UBS, I was a huge supporter of our philanthropy activities because I felt that they bring the dialogue with clients, particularly with wealthy families, to a new level. It usually then is no longer about what will the financial markets do in the next 1 to 2 or 3 or 4 years. It is then what are the values we are guided by. And it usually leads into an intergenerational dialogue. And so it makes the kind of quality of relationships with your clients much, much more rich in terms of content, in terms of values, in terms of ethics. And so that was one of the reasons I always felt that is a role that the largest wealth manager in the world can play in essentially creating awareness. And I mean, there is not a single wealthy family on this planet that has some relationship to philanthropy or to impact investing. I mean, this is a huge topic for wealthy people and particularly for young generations.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Sorry, did you say, Peter, that there isn't one family or there are a few families that still are not?
Most of them are.
Many family. I think today, what I hear from my colleagues that still are at the bank, I mean, every wealthy family, and particularly the young generation, they are highly interested in these topics.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I agree with you. I just wanted to double check, which also makes me think, you know, the great work that banks, in this case, you know, private banks and wealth managers can do is this linkage between the wealthy and those in need. And again, for the benefit of perhaps people that haven't listened to other episodes before or some of the articles that I write, we're talking about always about this spectrum of investment. And I like talking about sustainable investing as the big umbrella, impact investing within that, and philanthropy investing, which is what you are focusing on mainly, is within that impact spectrum, right? Or sub-spectrum.
I think it's interesting because I teach a course on precisely on the spectrum that also is gaining momentum. I think last term we had like 120 people from 140 participants now that joined. Also, to differentiate the private vehicles that you have with impact investing that go directly, I would say, into social enterprises or social business. And then you have like the public markets, the part of ESG integration that I will say is more than investing for impact directly, as we talk on impact investment, it's more investing with impact, not integrating this criteria. And that's more what we usually call sustainable finance. We try to differentiate the responsible and sustainable finance for the public market from a little bit the private markets and the impact investing. But at the same time, they both, I think, have kind of the same impact thesis at the end, that is bringing private capital to solve social and environmental problems, so to foster transitions that bring solutions, that is what we do, social innovation for social environmental programs. And so I do think that if you compare the impact investment with all the growth compared to the ESG and the asset managers, still small, not compared to, but they're both growing very fast.
Yeah. And I like that you're doing that because that's one of the reasons why I launched the podcast, is to just generate that awareness and that, you know, education in a way, humbly, so that people understand and can see where they can start, for example, which is the case of, you know, wealthy people with philanthropy. So just linking now to the point that you made about talent and leadership, right? Because we have the parallel worlds and now we have, you know, the different people and the different kind of statuses of wealth in the world. And then we have leadership. So that brings me nicely to kind of the organizations and companies that you work with, right? So let me share a short introduction about IMD and perhaps the foundation, and ideally then we can dig into the book. So about IMD, so the Institute for Management Development, IMD, at imd.org, is an independent academic institution with Swiss roots and global reach, founded 75 years ago by business leaders for business leaders. Its purpose is challenging what it is and inspiring what could be. They develop leaders who transform organizations and contribute to society. Based in Lausanne, in Switzerland, and Singapore. This is, I think, is fantastic and amazing because I don't know how many people know, but IMD's executive education programs have been ranked number one in the world by the Financial Times Executive Education Global Ranking for the last 9 consecutive years, so since 2012 to 2020. And it has been ranked in the top 5 for 17 consecutive years. So if you did not know about IMD, I hope you check them out now. So the MBA and executive MBA programs have repeatedly been singled out among the best in Europe and the world. They believe that this consistency at the forefront of the industry is grounded on IMD's unique approach to creating real learning, real impact. Really? That's kind of this, I don't know if it's the slogan, but I liked it.
It is. Yeah. We have it even in our logo, yeah.
And IMD has also stepped up its action and measurement efforts in the area of sustainability in recent years. So much so that EcoVadis announced the business school's silver rating for 2019, showing a clear year-on-year progression. And for those that, you know, like numbers, as of 2019, the institution had revenues of 135 million Swiss francs and a team between faculty and staff of about 300 people. Yeah. So it's really, really nice and really interesting to learn about it. And now if I just quickly mention about the ELEA Foundation for Ethics in Globalization. The foundation was created by Peter and Suzanne Wifley in 2006. Please check out the website. It's elea-foundation.org. Its purpose is to fight absolute poverty, which you mentioned before, which is, for example, daily incomes below $3 with entrepreneurial means. And it aspires to be a role model organization with global charisma in the field of entrepreneurial philanthropy. And this is the first time that I actually hear it that way. ELEA is a philanthropic impact investor with a focus on early stage impact enterprises in fields such as global agriculture, value chains, informal retail, and last mile distribution, employable skills building, and digital solutions. It employs a professional staff of approximately 20 people. And since inception up to the second quarter of 2020, the foundation made 40 impact investments. Is that about right?
Correct.
Perfect.
Thank you.
And finally, ELEA Center for Social Innovation at IMD. So hence, you know, the connection and the link, IMD, the foundation, and the Center for Social Innovation, which again, Vanina, you are the chair of that part, right?
Exactly. And the director of the center,
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. And so ELEA Center for Social Innovation, IMD, was established in 2017 with the mission to inspire and encourage leaders in business, government, and civil society to create social innovation in their respective areas of responsibility. The center's distinctiveness builds on IMD's access to the corporate world and business leaders, and on ELEA's expertise as well as its networks with impact entrepreneurs and impact investors. It creates and disseminates knowledge through articles, case studies. It contributes to IMD's open and customized executive education programs and forges connections between corporations, social innovation practitioners, and academic experts. So since we have you here today, if it is not evident already to everyone listening, we're going to be looking mainly to the foundation and the Center for Social Innovation and, of course, the book. So let me stop there and please tell me more about the foundation and what you do, please.
So should I start with ELEA and then maybe Vanina can
Yes, please.
About IMD. I mean, as you pointed out, and thank you very much for this extensive description. It feels good to hear it from someone else. We created ELEA in 2006. And there were really three major motivations. One was that I always felt globalization is the mega trend of our generation. And I already felt then what I think today is a mainstream thinking that globalization, yes, has a lot of potential for good, but it also is very difficult, very challenging. It has winners, it has losers. And so I felt that we needed to do something in order to make sure that those people who do not have a natural access to globalization opportunities are provided with such an access. And that's why we are called Ethics in Globalization. Of course, if you have the privilege to be born in Switzerland and to have a career in UBS, then you are on the sunny side of globalization. And so I always felt some sense of responsibility for those many hundreds of million people who are not on the sunny side of globalization. The second rationale was when I was a student, I was an economist. As you mentioned, I did my PhD on Swiss direct investment in Mexico. So poverty economics, development economics was always high on my passions. And I always felt that it should be the duty of an economist to understand what poverty is and what you can do about it. And so I was delighted to see 2 years ago kind of two empirical poverty economists being awarded the Nobel Prize, because that's really what economics should be about, to understand what poverty is. And so it's been a passion for me since my times of studies. And the third, I was extremely fortunate to become CEO at a very young age of 44 years. And I try to take good care of my mind and of my body. So I expect to live 90 plus or so. And so it had also a lot to do not only with financial planning, but also with life energy planning. And it was for me clear. And that was before the financial crisis. So that was in 2006, that at some stage I would want to do something different. And it was for me clear that I wanted to dedicate a large part of my life energy to this endeavor. So based on this, we created Elea with this very tangible purpose and with an idea to invest into companies that sustainably fight poverty in these areas. And in the book, we have many examples of ventures that actually do this and how we help them maximize their potential. So that's in a nutshell right now.
So from my side, I think the interesting part of the Elea Center for Social Innovation, I would say, is different from the foundation. So the name Elea actually comes because the generous donation of Peter and his wife and Peter's family actually to create the center. But the center has, I would say, a broader mission. So the mission of the Elea Center is to fight absolute poverty. But in our case, we really put at the center social innovation in general. So the idea is using market solutions that are more efficient and to solve social and environmental problems. But we look at both things, at the supply and the demand of social innovation. Those that provide social innovation, social entrepreneurs or corporates, corporate social innovation too, mm-hmm. and those that can finance social innovation, impact investors, and I would say ESG integration, sustainable finance in the public side. So what I like about the center is that it puts at the forefront social innovation. So what is that the problem? So it's not because you throw money or because you have money you invest that the problems are going to be solved. No. So the idea is we put at the center finding these market solutions that can scale up and address grand challenges, especially we could say that confront SDGs, for example, is a widely used framework these days. So what the Elea Center does, and I think the power of IMD also that, is having access to, and as you mentioned very well in the description, we have access to corporates, we have access to the private sector in general. So we bridge in a certain way these worlds of academics, of social entrepreneurs with corporates, so we can find collaborative solutions and we can think more holistically and systemically. You know? So I think Peter had that vision too when he wanted to create the center at IMD and maybe not in another institution. And I think IMD has that mission that you say that I actually love of challenging what it is and inspire what it could be. So that's a little bit what we want to do with social innovation. The way or the business models that we're using now, or the capitalism as we know now, many things are failing and not working and we're seeing the limitations. No, how can we inspire the change and foster action? No, and that's kind of what from my privileged side, I consider myself privileged. I'm the first holder of the Elea Chair and I get to lead this center, but also hoping to create a community around IMD of like-minded people that want to change things. No. And I think it's really a privilege.
And maybe just a word on why did we create this center from the Elea side? When we were 10 years old in 2016, we actually did a kind of a soul searching exercise. We asked ourselves, what have we learned? What should we do the next 10 years? What should we do differently? And one of the conclusions was that we felt we have such a tremendous level of insights, of data, of experiences, of cases, of concepts, frameworks, and so on, that it is in a way a shame that we don't make these available to a broader public, to academic use, to executives, to leaders. And obviously, given my over two decades of involvement in the leadership with IMD, it was for me obvious that IMD would be a partner to do that. And so that's why we donated the chair and provided the funds to start the center. And we also then brainstormed about what would be good projects. And one of our kind of early projects was actually to do a book together, because a book is always good because a book has a deadline at some stage to finish it, which is always great. And it forced us in a way to really go comprehensively about what we learned. We also got to know each other quite well, Vanina and I. By the way, the title of the book came from Vanina. I give her full credit, because I would not have had the self-confidence and the kind of courage to call it the Elea Way. So I'm grateful for Vanina just for the title of the book. And we had a tremendously good time in debating about what is in the book as a kind of a baseline for what the center should develop, as Vanina explained, along a much broader agenda, as a contribution to the whole sector of essentially impact investment and ESG integration.
Fantastic. That's really nice to hear. I'll come back to the book in a second. Just before we go there, I just wanted to check with you, because it's interesting how you talked about poverty, globalization, some of your drivers, right? And now, you know, social innovation with the center. But obviously, and you did the soul searching on 2016, which is very interesting, because then you didn't even know what was going to happen in the next 3-4 years, right? So I had this in my mind when I was preparing to talk to you about, you know, how you're approaching this maybe 2016 to 2020 and now 2010 to 21, right? So, and I'm assuming when we talk about the book and you finish it all through the pandemic at the beginning, but anything that you, I don't know, potentially recommend to listeners in terms of this approach between, you know, pre-2020 and now?
Well, we started conceptualizing the book in early 2018, and then we finalized a draft at the beginning of last year, and we were sending it to about 40 people, friends, academics, entrepreneurs, investors, people who know us well, for advice, for peer reviews. And we were just in early March, we were getting a lot of feedback, and we were overwhelmed, not only by quantity, but even more by the quality of a tremendous valuable input. And I was just about getting a little bit desperate when I looked at my agenda and at what work that would entail. And then guess what? 2 weeks later, my agenda was empty. So we spent essentially 3 months last summer before the summer break to finalize it. Very intense period. And at the same time, obviously, we had to always ask ourselves, well, what is still relevant, what we thought in the pandemic? And I must say, and I cross my fingers here, obviously, the first concern was, what will our investments, our 20 active ventures, how will they survive this? And so far, I can say they all survived. Some of them have to reinvent themselves, but they all survived. And it was a tremendously humbling experience for our team to work with the entrepreneurs. Because, you know, in Switzerland, we are one of the wealthiest countries on the planet. Obviously, the vaccination campaign is 3 weeks late. All our people start criticizing the government and get angry and are impatient. And when you compare our luxury problems with those that our entrepreneurs are faced, who have ventures in India, in South Africa, in Tanzania, in the Philippines, in Peru, in Bolivia. I mean, you are at a completely different level of essentially being affected by the pandemic and being affected even more by incompetent measures by governments who often do not care about the people, by institutions that are weak, that cannot implement policies, and that then create a lot of poverty by unintended consequences. And I must say, it's been a humbling experience to see how entrepreneurs fare to that. And what was in a way for us incredibly rewarding, and it was, I must say, we obviously went, as many people on the planet, through a test period of doing things we've never done before. I mean, We have now for 12 months worked remotely with our companies, doing board meetings with our ventures in all these countries. And I must say, we have never before proven our value as much by being an active investor and a partner. Because our ambition is always to be the first institutional investor after friends and family and angels in these companies, and to stay there until we can be the last philanthropic investor. That's our mantra. And so that can be anywhere between 5 and 10 years. And we have been tremendously kind of focused on getting the entrepreneurs, helping them get through the crisis. And that takes patience. I mean, sometimes we had to do emergency funding and we didn't exactly know how that would pay out. And I think their philanthropic capital coupled with a very active approach in partnering with the entrepreneurs has proven to be very valuable. So in that sense, I would say, of course, there are lessons learned, there are changes, but fundamentally, I feel that we have proven the test of time, even in crisis.
And from my side, I think also the pandemic brought some time actually to work together in this learning experience. But I think the other thing that the pandemic taught, and I think could be a silver lining from this privileged side, is much more momentum, no? And I think a change in urgency, this learning platform that let's build back better, let's do things differently. And also, I would say that at the mindset side, a recognition that systemic risks, things that we thought were maybe tail risk and that couldn't happen or low probability, can destroy a lot of value. And that a pandemic that we didn't think it was going to happen is having huge damage for value of corporations. No, so understanding, I think that brought a new understanding to climate change, to inequality issues, because inequality issues have, or social justice issues, if you think it lately. So I think this idea of the system became much more concrete than would have been in the past. And I think even though we live in a globalized world, this idea of interconnectedness is also much more evident, and that the solutions should be collaborative is also starting to gain momentum. So I think that could be the silver lining. On the other side, I also feel a tremendous responsibility on my side to speed up. We have momentum, now let's do something. And I think the book wants to foster that action. So let's learn together. Let's use pedagogy, training, access, mobilize our resources, our social capital to actually transform business models and find the solution. So I think it, from my side, even though it feels a little confined, we're not going out a lot, but it's sense of need for urgent action, I would say.
Yes, yes. I was going to say before, now you're also doing a podcast episode on top of the book. So you're able to share, you know, all of this great knowledge, Peter and Vanina. So I thank you for that. But I was going to say, I listened to my previous episode all the time, and I was listening to Nigel Kershaw, which is from the Big Issue Group and Big Issue Invest. And he was saying that one of the things that he noticed is that the lack of urgency, we recorded that maybe over a year ago before COVID. And I kind of agree more with you that that is the biggest shift I've seen. I could see the trend and I could see, you know, growing, but definitely I noticed obviously on the inflows, you know, as reported everywhere, but then also just on people's availability and action. So that is really good. So now if we then link it to the book and the name of the book. So what is the book about and why you wrote it? Perhaps Vanina, since you have the credit for the title.
The credit for the title, I think Peter in certain moments was a little modest and he was writing, we think we do, said, this is what you do, so let's own it. You know? And I also believe that there are a lot of great learning experiences, as you said, I think, that come from his whole career. He was a McKinsey consultant, so he had the side of building businesses and supporting businesses, you know, and also the financial piece of the story. So I think this makes a pretty unique book because you have the whole knowledge from the corporate sector, from the financial sector, and also I would say from the global experience and different regions and different challenges. So what we wanted to do with the book, and I think the part that I also wanted to add is I wanted to add to the experience some research frameworks, but also the pedagogy. So we wanted to create a book that could be used for professors, so that could be used in training, or that could be used as a self-learning tool. So at the end of the chapter, you have learning objectives, you have some ethical questions. There's a lot of, we can define impact investment and we can tell you intentionality, but then when you have to make the decisions are nuances. Do you go for what happens if you fight absolute poverty? What happens with environmental issues? The trade-offs. And so we try to show also those nuances, because the practice is not as easy as it may seem. No. So what we try to do with the book is exactly that, to have a very practical and hands-on, but also I would say a philosophical and even ethical reflection on some of these decisions that have consequences and sometimes can be idiosyncratic even in certain cases. No. So we try to marry both things, knowing we're very lucky with a publisher, and we didn't know that at the beginning with Routledge. But we were writing a book. When you look at a book, you tend to look at or see books that are for social entrepreneurs. And then you have books that are for impact investors. And they are kind of silo type books. And we try to write a book that talked to both. So we were having kind of running the risk of saying, okay, what's the audience? Who's the audience? What's the target audience? Your niche. And this was much broader, you know, and it has some teaching things that could appeal to professors, or this could appeal to MBA. So it was an eclectic book. And I think we are an eclectic pair. So I think that was fun part of writing this book. And I hope your audience will enjoy it, and that we actually appeal to the different lenses that you have for different people. I would say that at the end is, how do you mobilize private resources, private capital, private entrepreneurial ability, social capital to solve social and environmental problems, you know, and to foster innovation. And I think that was the interesting part for me.
Maybe adding to what Vanina just said, I mean, the starting point are really those on whose shoulders we stand. And these are, on one hand, social entrepreneurship. That's why we were privileged to get Bill Drayton to write us a foreword. And the other is impact investing, and equally privileged to get Andy Cooper, who pioneered LeapFrog, which was, I think, the first kind of company, investment company, that proved that profit and purpose works. And so very glad that both agreed to contribute a preface, because they are really the ones where we felt this is the starting point, these two trends. And then we essentially go on to elaborate how you can marry these two, how you can marry entrepreneurship and investing. And there are two different levels where you can do that. One is, how do you shape the investment organization? And that's where we describe the ELEA way, our own kind of operating model to identify new ventures, to scout them systematically, to due diligence, comprehensive deep dive due diligence, then to essentially partner with entrepreneurs, go in the boards, be very active partners, help them how to deal with capital, how to deal with investors, and to do that with other philanthropic investors, and to do that with talent, which is kind of a flywheel of three elements. Finding good investments helps us to mobilize philanthropic capital, and that again helps us to employ talented people who then again find great investments. So that's one level, one circle. And the other circle is obviously the entrepreneurs themselves and their enterprises, and how they go from plan, from kind of business plan competitions, to having a commitment to actually dedicate their life energy for the next 5, 10, 15 years to building this, to build an organization, to build governance, to develop strategies, to manage crises, to manage through ups and downs. And these are the two layers of integrating capital and entrepreneurship that we describe in the book. And then we end with a kind of conclusion, how to make this sustainable. And that has a lot to do with governance and has a lot to do with impact measurement. We have pioneered a method at ELEA very early on of measuring
our impact. Yeah, leave it there. Let me stop you. So we get everyone waiting for that one. Yeah. We're going to look at it towards the end. So don't give it away just yet. Okay. sorry, Peter, but I thought that was an interesting point that we should cover, and definitely let's cover it in a couple of questions. Just to recap, so that's really nice, because you cover the model in terms of the steps, so that is covered in the book. We're talking about capitalism, and there is a part in the introduction, which is, and I will, in a way, will try to mention for the audience so that they can then get the book, and then they can see where they can find the part. But we talked about reinventing capitalism, and this, you know, this tension between social and economic goals, which I think we said then just before we started recording, we could talk for days and cover the whole book and, you know, your 20 plus years or more of experience. But we understand that there is that tension. Then we briefly talked about the trade-off, this trade-off debate, you know, between these tensions and the principle of additionality, which I think right at the beginning, you, Vanina, mentioned when we were talking about what is, you know, impact investing. So anything that all of that you want to maybe dig a little bit more or maybe explain, you know, additionality or the trade-off, or perhaps before I move in to the next questions?
On my side, on additionality, I think this is kind of sometimes an important issue, and especially for philanthropic impact investors, because one of the things that you want to assure is if you're bringing, philanthropic capital, or you're accepting below market returns, you don't want to crowd out other money, other private investors. So what you really want is to become catalytic and allow, as Peter was saying, in practice, in a certain way, they want to be the last philanthropic money that they receive, and that once that money finishes, they're able to get commercial money or additional money. So I think that market building is, at least for me, a very interesting role that philanthropic impact investors have, because that was the space that we thought that capitalism didn't work. No, that is, there are no incentives, it's too risky, we cannot build it. So that this market building, this catalytic role that some public, that some private players can play and bridge these spaces to create viable private market solutions, for me, it's very interesting. Now, and I think this discussion goes further. You're going to see it in green bonds. Why do we have green bonds and we don't have just bonds? No, is there additionality there? You're going to see it in regulation. You're going to see it in different other things. Or this idea additionality is really difficult to prove, to explain, and to work in practice. But I think cracking it up, the additionality pieces will bring a lot of impact and a lot of change in the market.
And I think what makes this work is a stance on ethics. I think you cannot have additionality without having a clear understanding of what you want to achieve and what exactly the ethical root of your impact definition is. And I must say that is maybe something that I see as a little bit of a temptation right now and a bit of a hype, that you have all these hundreds of impact funds. And when you look at how they define impact, it's incredibly superficial. I mean, it's typically two or three lines. I may say, well, we support SDG A to Z, either more social or more environmental, but we feel that fund managers and investors should just take a deeper ethical stance on what they understand when they talk impact. And I mean, there are trade-offs between different impact goals. For example, we are about poverty. That means that sometimes people hurt the planet, right? I mean, the planet would be better off without people. So if you want to provide livelihoods to poor people, not so easy to always square that with climate change, for example. And I think it's really, really important that we have a thorough debate that is also kind of guided by academic thinking on what are different areas of impact, how do you define them, what are the relationships between them, and what are the very basic underlying ethical principles. So in our case, it was liberal ethics. I mean, I'm a strong believer in freedom. I'm a strong believer in accountability. I'm not a strong believer into authoritarian regimes. I think that stands, particularly in today's world where you have everything between Confucius on one hand and Ayn Rand on the other hand, and a lot of things in between. It's important that you, in a way, anchor this with an ethical perspective.
Okay. Yes. You cannot leave me really thinking deeply, both of you, as you speak and say all of this. And again, thank you for sharing those thoughts, you know, beyond the book, but I guess that, you know, will fall within the why you're doing everything you're doing and why you wrote it. And on the additionality point, I was thinking, you know, about, obviously yesterday I got asked the question again, you know, about greenwashing or, you know, impact washing. And obviously, in Europe, you know, with the upcoming of the Article 8, Article 9 to define you know, what actually is and what they're really doing in terms of funds, you know, to create impact.
Yeah.
That's going to be interesting because as you read it, by the way, I don't think I can see the word additionality across any of the taxonomy, or it's really about impact and measurement, or, you know, what actual impact is having. But I'm really happy about it. And I think that it's going to take us a bit further towards being true and aligned to the ethics, you know, while creating profit. You know, I think that, and I always say, we cannot ask every human to be the same. There are people that are just money people and money minds, and they just struggle to be, to either, you know, care or to be ethical. And that is just unfortunately, is the make of a sinful human. But we'll have to work towards that. And I think that this is really helpful. And in terms of helpful, I was just going to highlight, you know, that what I picked up from the summary of the book, which I really like, is that it says here that the book offers practical advice on how to best integrate entrepreneurship and capital for impact and innovation by using Elea's philanthropic investing approach to fight absolute poverty with entrepreneurial means as an example. And then also, I picked up towards the end, it says, include suggestions on how to lead impact enterprises in such areas, developing strategies, plans, models, build effective teams and organizations, managing resources. And you actually have real life examples, I think you mentioned before, but again, which it really helps, you know, entrepreneurs, investors, philanthropists, policymakers. So it's really a practical and all-inclusive book. That's what it sounds like. So I highly recommend it. And on that note, Vanina and Peter kindly offered to give away a couple of electronic copies. So if you are interested, if you're listening to this podcast, we're going to start with the first five, but we may have more. Please go to Island Partners website and send us a message via the contacts page with the subject Daily Away, and we'll do a quick giveaway. So thank you. Thank you both for that.
You're welcome. And we should maybe say that we both renounced our fee for the book and will be all donated to Elea. So we will not have any personal gain from it. So whoever buys a book copy supports Elea.
That's very nice. That's very kind. And that's Elea. When you say Elea, it's the foundation, right?
The foundation, yes.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Thank you. So if we now move towards, you know, some of these examples, perhaps, you know, and I like the title sometimes about your client and the people, you know, that come to you. But I picked up from the book that you talked about Elea's investment focus and the three-stage model and the stage two investments. Can you share a little bit more about that?
Yes, when we look at how impact enterprises are created, they typically follow three phases. The first phase is where essentially you develop an idea, a plan, a concept, a prototype. And this is actually an area which is quite well covered. There is today almost an industry of business plan competitions that are well sponsored by foundations, by corporations. One can even be a little bit cynical about it, that in some countries in Africa, people go from competition to competition and get the money. And so this is an area which is actually, there's a lot going on, and where obviously it's very attractive to support it because you meet great people, you see very creative ideas. But then at some stage, an entrepreneur has to make a life decision, which is, do I now want to quit my job? Do I want to dedicate my life and the life of a few colleagues to building this company? And that is when the financial commitments and the life energy commitments are getting really, really sizable. That's when a little bit of money from friends and family will not suffice. That's when you need tickets of a few hundred thousand of dollars and not a few ten thousands of dollars. We talk about the pioneer gap, and that is essentially when you invest a lot of time into getting something up, but you don't know yet whether it works. So revenue comes later, risks come before. It's also called the valley of death in Silicon Valley.
And so
that's the second phase. And that's actually when we come in, and organizations that do similar things that we are. So we then invest. So these are companies. These are not business plans, not concepts. They're companies. They have clients. They have products. They have services. They have a team. They typically have revenue between $500,000 and $2 million. We invest a few hundred thousand into risk capital, and we invest a lot of time. So we say that for every Swiss franc or dollar we invest in risk capital, we invest another dollar or Swiss franc into helping them in governance, in building a team, in building an organization, in refining strategies, and particularly in the past 12 months in managing crises. And then at some stage, that can take anywhere from 5 to 7 to 10 years, companies reach a certain maturity, they reach a certain scale, they reach a stability that they then become attractive for more commercially oriented impact funds such as Leapfrog, such as Partners Group Impact Investments. So companies that look for both impact and financial returns. And that's our goal. So we want to be the last philanthropic investor, and we then want to kind of get others in that can further scale up the companies. That's our kind of way of how to develop companies. And the three major themes we deal with are global agricultural value chains, for the simple reason that in poor countries, most of the people who are poor are smallholder farmers. So whoever comes with a concept that provides cash income to poor smallholder farmers with an innovative model, we look at. One example is in Peru, Inca moss, where in the kind of Andean Alps, you have a very special moss that grows there and that is great for flowers, for orchids, for kind of very sophisticated flowers. And so we help a community of about 6,000 poor farmers up there on 3,000 meters in really, really poor relations. They have no cash income to talk of. They have goats. They have a bit of basic subsistence farming. And by collecting and exporting this moss, they can get maybe between $50 and $100 per year cash income. So that would be one of these examples. The second topic is informal retail, last mile distribution. Here we have, for example, one case in India, which is Dharma Life, which is a company that reaches 40,000 villages in India, overall about 13 million people with Dharma Life entrepreneurs. These are local entrepreneurs who provide them with goods, with the services, with information in order to help them in their livelihoods. And the third area is employable skill building, which is to help people essentially develop skills that makes them kind of marketable in the labor market. An example here is Bagosphere, which is an enterprise in the Philippines that offers short courses to young people from rural areas that makes them employable in the service industry of the Philippines. And the fourth basket is digital solutions, which is a bit of an opportunistic basket of solutions in the digital space that help provide opportunities and fight poverty. So these are, in a nutshell, a few examples. There are many more in the book.
Pretty good. Oh, that's really good. Really helpful. Really helpful. And anything that you would like to add, Vanina, in terms of analysis or any of the examples that perhaps, you know?
No, and I think I had the opportunity, and probably we'll talk later about the LEA entrepreneurial community, you know, but we're building a training program. I had opportunity to talk very recently with some of these entrepreneurs. And as you can imagine, if you talk about building last mile distribution and you talk about training facilities, you can imagine how much this has been hit by COVID, you know, and how disrupted COVID can be. But at the same time, by talking to these entrepreneurs and the support they've gotten by the LEA Foundation to pivot very quickly and with patient capital, I think they might end up strengthened after this crisis because they had to go into digital solutions for the training, yeah. Into online.
Yeah.
A lot of the people are also connected, and at the end this may help and afterwards hopefully to scale up even faster and to reach more people. So I think the interesting piece of having a partner in crime, I would call, that you can bounce back ideas, that is patient, that knows you, and that has the DNA, not only the return to the capital but also the enterprise building, I can see very clearly how those solutions, how those transformation, and I think as an academic, I'm interested in that, also on a corporate level, how you finance transformations, how those transformations happen in a very short span, and there are a lot of pressure and constraints. You know? So that maybe, Peter, is our next book.
Yes.
I don't think we'll get it, like we need a break. But yeah. I think the financing, the transformation piece and the agile part of that, and how can you build something that is a liability into a strength of your business model and turn it around, I find very, very interesting. No, and I think the book a little bit gives the foundation for that. Yeah. It's not necessarily directly talking about COVID, even though we have a part about COVID, how those building blocks or those foundations allow you to actually understand how you need to pivot, how you need to change, to adjust and to scale.
Well, that's fantastic. And the one thing that I find very valuable, and I would say I love, is to real life stories from real organizations that are doing this. What I find, you know, fascinating is learning about organizations like Elea Foundation and sharing with people, because I think that's what we need to do, to share these best practices to so that we can replicate, because there is so much, you know, to do and there is so much that people can do. But it's interesting that the information, and again, thank you so much, you know, to the foundation, Fide and your wife, and this idea of, okay, we have all this data. I heard you say, you have all this data, you have all this experience, and, you know, what can we do? And sharing it in the book. And the point that you made about how COVID, we'll touch on this perhaps. Vanina is also from Argentina, and we have a saying in Spanish, and Peter speaks Spanish as well, that says, no hay mal que por bien no venga. And in a way, what I noticed, I was talking to, and I'll take advantage to mention, an organization called Acción, based in DC, acción.org. And when I see the decades of work that they have been doing, it's fascinating. And then the point that came up was this digitalization, that all of a sudden, there is a lot of work to do, but all of a sudden, there is a real need because people cannot be in person. So everyone had to digitalize. So I can, it really resonates when you mentioned that. And the fact that, yeah, sorry, and the fact that the last point.
Let me tell you a second, because I don't want to, this COVID crisis had sent millions of people also in absolute poverty again, and a huge backlash. So the more important you see these solutions being, so sadly we're still not in that silver lining at a large scale. No. So I think we still need that sense of urgency that you were talking, because not everybody and elite entrepreneurs can count on some of them, but there's still a huge and urgent need for that support and that partnership.
I think what's encouraging here is this mainstreaming. I mean, Vanina talked about the corporate side, and I must say for me that the last pre-COVID highlight was the week we were together in Lima in Peru with an elective of our executive MBA students, over 30 students, mainly seasoned, experienced executives from very different industries. And we had an entire week where we were essentially, which was organized by the ILEA Center, and where we did cases. We did this Incomos case. We asked them to interview social entrepreneurs. And I must say, for me, it was a huge highlight to see how much momentum this has with very regular corporations, which I think even 5 years ago would not have been the case. So I think there is a mainstreaming of these ideas where social entrepreneurship, impact entrepreneurship, and normal corporate leadership converges.
Absolutely.
And the last point I was going to make, it was around the education part. So again, it's one of my kind of top one, actually, in terms of SDGs as well. Education is, you know, what I care the most about, because I believe that helps with a lot of the others. That's my values and how they align. But the fact that, you know, we are helping and you are helping and these organizations are helping educate people to try to bridge all the different gaps, you know, is extremely, extremely valuable and important. So moving on swiftly to identifying and measuring impact. So now you get the chance to talk about, you know, there is the methodology, and there is a section in the book which is called Methods, and the EIMM, which is the ILEA Impact Measurement Method. So please.
Yes, thank you. That was, I think, really something that from the very outset we wanted to be clear about, and that may have to do with my background. I mean, having been both a McKinsey consultant and a banker and an economist, I mean, I wanted to know what I'm doing and why I'm doing it and how I notice when I'm doing it well. I think that was the origin of it. And so we actually looked at various methods that were used, but we got a little bit frustrated because there are hundreds of different methods. Some of them are very, very simple. Some of them are very, very complicated, very, very expensive to do. And we somehow did not find one that would allow comparability, that would be practical enough to not absorb too much resources, and that would be meaningful. And so we started inventing our own methodology, essentially, obviously tailored to our purpose, which is absolute poverty. So we start with poor people and their households, and then we look how they are positively impacted at the level of themselves, but also at the level then of the enterprise, of the concept, of the organization. We developed a series of different factors that we compile and we measure, and we created our own currency in a way, ILEA impact points per 1,000 Swiss francs. And we use that for essentially three goals. One is to set goals and control our implementation. So for every venture we do in due diligence, it is a mandatory piece that we want to know how many impact points do we aspire to achieve and how do we measure regularly, once per year at least, how we're doing. The second is to really have comparability across different ventures and to make good capital allocation decisions, because we want to know why we are investing into these ventures and not other ventures. And so it is essentially a capital allocation tool. And the third is to communicate with our external philanthropic investors. We don't just want them to see great pictures of happy kids being now able to kind of have better livelihoods. I mean, that's also important to appeal to emotions. But in addition to emotions, we want to give them a regular performance reporting once a year and what they are expected from their bank and what they expect from their private equity fund. And so we have essentially a philanthropic impact performance report, PIPER, as we call it, that we produce once a year and that is audited by an external audit firm that essentially tests whether we follow our own guidelines when we measure our impact. And so I must say we have now done this. We've started very early on. We have now done this in an audited way for over 10 years. And it has changed the way we make decisions and has become much, much more systematic, much more concentrated. And we often also use it as a tool of dialogue internally, but in some instances, even with our entrepreneurs as well.
And let me add on that a little bit from the outside, because Peter is explaining how those impact points allow them to make decisions. But from my side, and I can add an anecdote into this and two things is, I participated in one of the meetings with the donors, the Lea Circle, and it was fun to see the different donors that were at this dinner comparing points, impact points. So how many impact points do you have? How many? And it wasn't just to compete on the points, but they were really internalizing the impact. So I think about sometimes when you talk about impact can be very abstract. And the picture can be gimmicky. So you want the pictures too, but can be so. But if you marry both, they get to understand. And even sometimes if the impact points go back or are negative in time with during COVID, at least they understand that this is what is behind those points that are on life's touch or what kind of impact it has. So I think it has a really good way of internalizing impact. And I also think, and I was just thinking now, and I don't think I mentioned this to Peter, internally at Elea, it also fosters discussion, you know, because part sometimes, and I think when we talk about qualitative measurements of impact in certain cases, there is a part that is idiosyncratic or is judgment-based, and that's why you want diversity of your opinions. And I know the team, I know how much they discuss when they do in order to really have grounded way that are okay, certain points. Obviously, some are easier and very quantitative, but some others that they have a thorough discussion of understanding that impact. And also, behind is the theory of change. You know, and I think whenever you talk about impact, you need that. Peter mentioned that you need to know what you want to get in the investment, how much, what impact you want to get at the end. So, quantifying in a certain way ties your hands in that path. And I think that can be part of not having numbers for having numbers, but what can you achieve in the understanding of impact and in the decision-making process through those numbers.
The dream is that at some stage, in 5 to 10 years, impact becomes tradable, right? And that because these kind of currencies become real currencies, and maybe blockchain will help us here to basically create markets with impact, because it's still a fact while many people talk about impact and think it's great. But when you actually look at financials, I mean, they are still traded at a discount, right? Because there are no instruments around how you could make impact tradable. And at the end, yeah, my dream would be at some stage that impact would be traded with a premium, not with a discount.
So if I, just from my own understanding and perhaps clarification, so the foundation has its own funds, but then you also get donors into the foundation and then effectively you invest through the foundation, correct?
We don't call them donors. We call them philanthropic investors.
Sorry, that was me.
Because donors are essentially people who just give money.
Yes.
Technically, our philanthropic investors also give us money. We are a tax-exempt foundation, so it is money that is donated technically, but we look at them as people who give us philanthropic capital, and we treat them as investors who essentially transform money into impact. So they essentially invest their capital. 90% of what they commit goes into specific ventures, both risk capital, but also expenses associated with supporting this venture by, for example, being in the boards, by helping them with strategy, with organization building, with crisis management. And 10% goes into our indirect expenses. And these are essentially our pipeline. We are a lean organization. We don't do tail fundraising. We don't do big marketing. So we essentially, our indirect expenses are finding new ventures and doing due diligence on them and deciding them positively. And there we have built this circle of ELEA philanthropic investors, which is by now a circle of about 40 individuals, families, companies. For example, Accenture Switzerland is a partner for many years now who helps us not only with funds, but also with talent, with teams, with expertise. And they do that as part of their corporate responsibility program, Skills to Succeed, which is a global Accenture corporate social responsibility program. And so that's how we are funded.
Very nice. And I just love learning about the different models. But again, the investors do not get the money back, right? So it just all stays and gets reinvested.
Yes.
Perfect. And then again, you know, we don't need to, and we tend not to advertise any specific performance as such, but is there anything that you can share in terms of, you know, the multiples of how it has grown with these active investments that you have?
Well, we have in the book a section where we asked ourselves exactly that question. And since we exist, we have done about 40 investments. Slightly over half of them have been at or above our own kind of impact goals. Another quarter has been positive, but not exactly at our ambition level. Another quarter, final quarter, we had either to abandon because it didn't work, or we don't know yet because they are too early. So that's more or less, and that's a normal distribution that you would find in regular private equity portfolios or VC portfolios. What's maybe special about our sector is when in Silicon Valley, you basically have outperformance, you have 1,000x, right? And they essentially fund all the hundreds of failures that we at least so far have not found in our sector of absolute poverty, simply because we're talking financially underdeveloped areas, of course, since we're talking absolute poverty. So I would say the most successful in terms of financial return is maybe around 10 times, maybe 12 times. It's not 50, it's not 100, it's not 1,000. And that's why we are philanthropic. I mean, you could argue that the whole global VC industry, if you take the top percent out, is also philanthropic. It's loss-making. And if you don't have that top 1%, you would actually have to fund it with philanthropic capital. So that's why we are philanthropic, because we lack this tremendous outperformance. We are investing in very early, and they need a lot of support beyond capital.
Yes. Yes. So I've heard, especially in the US, a concept of venture philanthropy, which is like their way to look at it potentially in terms of, you know, marrying between philanthropy, what you are doing, which is entrepreneurial philanthropy, and actual venture capital. Right? So, yeah.
We had this discussion at the beginning of the book on what to call it, and we went for philanthropic impact investing because we thought that the word investing had to be, that it wasn't just venture philanthropy, that there was this expectation of cash on cash return, even though it's no returns for ELEA, but we're talking about investing, not only. But it's interesting because it is the same space that the academic literature calls venture philanthropy.
Yeah. Because the challenge, and I was going to try to put you on the hotspot here, when you sit with your board, is I notice when I talk to investors, as much as they want to learn about sustainable and impact investing, and specifically in some cases, you know, the social impact, it tends to, I don't know, I'm just going to say a bold number of 90% always go back to financials. And then you realize that very quickly the conversation changes. Although, you know, the people that have been doing it for quite some time, like yourself, show that if you keep focusing on the impact, you'll get the returns as well. So that's a dilemma on itself as well. And I challenge people always to think, okay, when they're talking, you know, are they talking about impact for the sake of it, or are they just really always focusing just on the money?
I think the truth of the matter is it's both and it's not either or. So, of course, if you invest into more advanced impact companies that have a certain scale, there doesn't need to be a trade-off. I mean, for example, base of the pyramid companies, they achieve impact with every additional revenue and they also add to profitability with every additional turnover that they make selling products and services. But as you develop companies from scratch through these different phases, every enterprise has a period where it needs philanthropic capital. It may not call it like that. It may call it angel capital. It may call it venture philanthropy. It may call it whatever names. But the fact is, you will not get a mature, profitable impact enterprises without a period in between where you need philanthropic capital. So if I were rational about it, I would say it's okay to invest 80% of your funds into commercial impact funds, investing at companies at scale, but you should invest maybe 20% into philanthropic capital, because otherwise there aren't these 80%, right?
Somebody you need has to build the pipeline, exactly. There is a pipeline problem.
And I think what we see from our work, awareness for this is building. I mean, originally, we had a lot of debate with our entrepreneurs and exactly this question. I mean, a lot of our philanthropic investors in Elea are entrepreneurs, and they recognize that. And so I think this is a continuous awareness process. But it is fair to say that our phase two space is the least crowded. I mean, there are not thousands of philanthropic impact investors. There are a few dozen. We know a few of them, but it's not crowded. And so I guess if we can kind of have a call to action among our listeners, please look at what's scarce. And so that's an area which still needs support.
Okay. Can I add something, Carl? You mentioned before the spectrum of capital. And when you look at the spectrum of capital, you have the venture philanthropy or philanthropic impact investing. Then you usually have with market returns, impact investment, like impact first, impact investing. And then you can have another group that could be financial first impact investing. Know that you can differentiate in intentionality and the type of people, and you can have different companies there. So usually are part of this social capital or financial capital spectrum you mentioned. But I also wanted to mention something else on the mindset, because you talk about the financial side having this mindset of profit first or return first and understanding the impact side. Let me switch it to the other side. Sometimes it happens on the philanthropic side or even in the regulatory side for the foundations. It's hard for them to understand that you want profitable ventures to become self-sustainable and that you can use other tools that are not only grants, you know, that you're getting into equity, but you're not supposed to make money. And so I think that dichotomous mindset works both sides, and we are in a gray area that sometimes is difficult to navigate successfully, you know. So to get into the conversation, to understand that there is a space that marries both, that this return sometimes can be below market returns or market returns, and that can get recycled, but they're needed for the sustainability of the business, and it's not just grants, you know.
Perfect. That's a very, very good point. Thank you very much, Vanina. It's bringing the both together. And then, so the one thing I took away from the linking them back to the measurement is this, I can't remember what you call it, the PIPR. No.
PIPR,
right? Because I think that is where a lot of people struggle, just trying to understand, okay, the impact and then how you measure it. And that's where we're going, you know, at the most developed markets as well, right? So I insist, and, you know, obviously, if they get the book, they'll get to see and learn, because some of these things, you know, as you said, if you make it simple and you can see some examples, then you can relate it to your own business and your own asset classes and sectors, etc. So very good point. As we wanting to wrap up, let's go to like the last couple of questions, if that's okay with you. And again, I don't want to get into policies too much. You know, obviously, this is all within kind of private investments or private sectors, right? So it's a bit maybe less regulated, but maybe that's a conversation for another time. But I did want to talk about the future. And this, again, linking back to the beginning of the episode and this question about the sustainable investment dilemma. And you know, from maybe from a broader perspective, what is that you think that financial services businesses can adopt to become more sustainable and have, you know, an impact, you know, to others in them in the world? And then linked to that is, you know, how do we scale? And then obviously, please do talk about specifically, I think you mentioned it quite a lot about philanthropic investment, but any golden nuggets, you know, any suggestions that you think that we could put out there for, again, UBS is leading the way. Again, I'm not paid by UBS, just a big fan. And you see, I even repost some of the things that they share all the time, especially their CIO, but others, you know, that are just coming behind.
Well, I have a section, one of the last sections in the book that is called essentially impact-aligned ecosystems beyond single organizations. And I think the more that we advanced our thinking, Vanina and I, we came to exactly that question. And that single organizations, I mean, they are great in the sense that they have clear missions and they have clear accountability and you can measure them and so on. But at the end, when you look at the really successful kind of scale plays in that arena, they are typically ecosystems where they work together. They work together with development finance organizations. They may be orchestrated by big banks. They may work together with NGOs, with aid organizations who have a lot of experience locally on, for example, behaviors of poor people. And so most of our most successful enterprises, they are part of an ecosystem that they drive. An example is Dharma Life, which is a hybrid organization working on one hand with a commercial model to selling solar devices and other kind of meaningful goods and services, but at the same time working with organizations such as IFC or such as big companies like Unilever or big foundations like Bill and Melinda Gates Foundations to create awareness among the 13 million people in rural areas of India, for example, for hygiene, for ladies' hygiene, for COVID prevention, and so on. And I think that's, in my book, the future. I think it's not creating bigger institutions and organizations, consolidation, vertical consolidation. I think it's horizontal networking. It's getting different types of organizations aligned. And that requires what I called in my previous book, inclusive leadership. That's what it's called. I think that needs a horizontal leadership approach where you talk about partnerships, where you don't talk about hierarchies, but about how to build bridges cross-sector. And I think that's why it's so incredibly important that we don't trade off private sector versus public versus NGOs, even though obviously they are different, but the power of them comes together when they are in alignment and when they work together and when you have people who build bridges. And I think financial organizations are in a very good position actually to build such bridges.
Yeah, the key word I think you mentioned right at the beginning was the partnerships, right? So, sorry, Vanina.
No, in my case, I have a whole line of research that I find very promising. And still, I think as impact investment has gained momentum and philanthropic impact investment too, I think what I'm going to mention now that is called blended finance, I think is still, the jury's out. It's still relatively small and hard, but I think extremely promising. And it comes precisely what Peter is mentioning, is it blends, it puts together capital from different sources, philanthropic, public, and private, and it tailors to the different risk appetite of investors. You know, sometimes the development banks and the public money or the philanthropists take the first loss in a fund, for example, to make the project viable and de-risk it. And then you bring the private sector at scale. So you take that 30% or even sometimes a little bit more that de-risk the project. And then the private sector, obviously, with certain risks, gets different tranches with different returns and different times, and then you can multiply this into 100 million funds, you know, rather than smaller funds. So we are starting to see an SDG fund of 500 million. You're starting to see blended finance facilities. The problem yet, I would say, and it happens with philanthropic impact investing, is the transaction cost. So doing a due diligence, how long it takes, Peter, as you were saying, $1 and $1 It may take a year until you find a viable company, you know, or half a year. Imagine if you have a private bank with the compliance people, and then you have a corporate that may be the off-taker and buying the goods and services of the entrepreneurs. And then you have the philanthropist with another regulation. And then they have the development bank. You have like 700, 800 pages, contracts and lawyers, and extremely expensive. So still it's difficult to scale and to get off ground. And I think regulation could have a role there, understanding that this needs to be more agile and work, still avoid greenwashing and allowing accountability. But I think this idea of collaboration and blended finance is very promising, or at least I'm finding very interesting.
Brilliant. I just remember I was reading Dalio's principle of the day today. He said, you have to synthesize the situation, right? And this is kind of about simplicity, synthesizing. I thought it was relevant to mention. That's very, very useful. Thank you. And as we have the last couple of questions, I didn't want to go. So we talked, and thank you, Peter. You gave a really nice story about how you develop, from your career into the foundation, what you're doing. But I realized, and I tend to ask this question later, that I didn't ask you as much, Vanina. So maybe, and this time, can I ask you, how did you end up? Are you both in Lausanne right now?
I'm in Lausanne and Peter in Zurich.
Zurich, okay.
But both in Switzerland, yeah.
Yeah. And so from Argentina via Peru, now Lausanne, and doing what you're doing. I know that we can do a whole episode just on you, Vanina. We may have to. By the way, I should do one on Leapfrog, which is on the list as well, because you mentioned it. But I don't know, kind of how did you evolve and what drove you perhaps to get to this, where you are right now?
I think it was kind of serendipity, I would say, in a certain way. And on the other hand, I feel very privileged, and I have to thank IMD and Peter for this opportunity, because I think I found a spot when I can marry different things of my personality. I study political science in Argentina, as you mentioned. So I always would like an idealistic person that wanted to change the world and the system. And that was my idea of understanding systems and this idea of impact. But I always had this mindset that it's not enough just to say you wanted to do good things, that you needed to measure things. And so I decided at that time that I really like economics, and I wanted to get a little bit into even quantitative types of economics. I mean, my PhD dissertation on macroeconomics, I think, if you come from Argentina, like both of us, understanding the macroeconomy in our life becomes a big deal. So I actually went and I studied Argentina exchange rate crisis. So at the time I was living kind of these two lives. I was working on econometric models and macroeconomics, but at the same time I had all this. Macroeconomics also gives you a systemic view, because I think if you move one thing, it changes something else.
Yes.
But I had this need of more practitioner-driven impact type of work. And I think I worked for a while in the UN as a consultant. I did different things. I worked as a consultant for corporations, and I always looking to foster change. So I think at a moment I said, okay, if I'm not going to change the world from the UN, maybe I'll change it as a consultant to business. And I said, okay, maybe that's too late. I'm just kidding. But so if I don't change it from the corporate sector, maybe I need to go before to teach. Okay, let's do it from the university when you have access to all of this. And I do think that this space that I'm now, it marries both things, because it marries my drive for impact, but also my economies, my financial side on the other side. And I think the book is a little bit for me too, even though it's Peter's Elea Foundation. It's also a journey for me of thinking about impact, of thinking about economics, of thinking about pedagogy, because it has a piece of pedagogy there. So I think that's what drove me also to IMD, that is a very particular business school that not only does academic sound work, but it's also very practitioner driven, and it aims to be relevant for executives. So I think I'm one of those privileged people that get to work in what they love, and also to put it on paper even better. So I think COVID year was a good year for me.
Fantastic.
From a very privileged side.
That's very, very nice to hear. Very nice to hear. Thank you for that. And then I sometimes maybe more on private forums, but I do talk about the bottom up and the top down, and I can see IMD, Elea Foundation, the center, and everything that you're doing is both. You're on the ground, you are now trying to disseminate, right, and plant the seed of best practices. And obviously, you're working with some of the best leaders in the world. So on behalf of, you know, everyone, I humbly, you know, thank you for everything that you're doing and for taking this path in your life. So the last two, this is called obviously impact leaders. And, you know, because I'm passionate about leadership myself. And so, but I do tend to ask, especially for people like yourselves, you know, that work with leaders of, you know, some of the best and biggest leaders in the world at every level, is, and obviously most relevant to IMD, even, you know, with everything that you do and even the name. But what is a leader, or more specifically, an impact leader to you? What defines one?
Maybe start as I wrote the book on leadership, and I looked up what the definitions are, and the longest definition is about one page. I will not quote it.
I'll put it on the notes. Yeah.
Leadership is intentional influence. And I guess that's what for me an impact leader is. And in my understanding of leadership, I think that there are three criteria. I think the first is ethics. I do think leadership has to be tied to ethics, to an ethical framework, to a values-based. I think leadership cannot be kind of aethical without ethics. The second is leadership should be more horizontal than vertical, particularly in today's global world and complicated world. So I think leaders are here to build bridges and to bring things together and avoid all these kind of stonewalling, all these siloing that results from some of our political tendencies right now. So I think leaders are called to build bridges. And the third and the most important is leaders are to get things done. I mean, just words will not change anything. So leaders have to get things done.
Thank you.
And from my side, again, I'm an economist, not a leadership. I have the privilege to work with a lot of leaders and maybe watch from afar, I would say, from my spot. Something that I like is those people that are able to transform the I in an us. No, that, and I think the leadership of today is that it's kind of this idea of a movement of mobilizing other people toward action around solving problems. And this is what I like to work on, social innovation. No, so you put the problem first, and you need to be able to mobilize resources for action, as Peter is saying, and not in a selfish way, not in a, it is about you, but it's about other people feeling represented about who you are and the purpose you have and the problems you want to solve. So that's the kind of leadership that we want to have at the center. We want to build that us around this purpose. You know?
Brilliant. Thank you so much. If I may add, you know, maybe one to take away and to think, but it's interesting the point about everything that you made, by a point about ethics. And I also been thinking particularly a lot during last year about integrity and kind of saying, believing in, specifically in the case of ethics, and being integral, you know, outside and inside, right? So, you know, outdoors, indoors, if you know what I mean. So I just challenge everyone, all leaders, to think about that. But thank you so much. Ethical, horizontal, action-based, and us rather than I. Okay. Last one is basically a call to action. I think you mentioned one before, Peter, but if you have any specific call to action and how can people get in touch with you, and that would be the last point.
Well, we are very simple. We have our website, which, as you said, is elea-organization.org. And please feel free to get in touch with us. I think for me, it's, we have talked about sense of urgency, and I think this is great. At the same time, I think we need to learn and we need to be thorough. I mean, there is a lot of hype, and I mentioned it before. Right now, there is so much money around, and I think we need to make sure that we don't waste this money. I mean, we have wasted a lot of public aid, development aid post Second World War. And we need to make sure that with all the sense of urgency, with all the momentum that we now have in this whole area, we are thorough in what we do. And in my view, entrepreneurship is more on the critical path, a scarcer resource than money. So watch out for entrepreneurial talent and support entrepreneurial talent.
And on my side, I think in the same line of Peter is we have to learn. and IMD is a learning space, you know, and it's, I would say it's a neutral, safe space with people with different interests, with different views, can meet to precisely foster this collaboration. And this is kind of the space that I want to create. So if you want to become, as we talked, a partner in crime, just contact me, because we are trying to build the agenda forward and fast, you know, so to understand that IMD is a space to speed at scale, to learn and to transform business models. So
fantastic. Thank you so much. Partners in positive crime.
Exactly. In ethical.
And what resonates to me is kind of educate yourself, take action in partnerships and measure it. That's kind of, you know, if I could, you know, try to summarize almost 2 hours of recording, I think. Thank you so, so much, Vanina, Peter. A real honor and a pleasure.
Likewise. Thank you, JP. Very good questions.
Thank you. And I hope everyone enjoys. So it is bye for now and until our next episode of Impact Leaders. And God bless you all. Thank you very much for your support. And please remember to check our sponsor's website for more information and updates. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by ILA and partners. Please connect with us to work together in the transition of capital into sustainable and impact investing. If you would like to support the podcast more specifically, we will be soon launching the Supercast and Patreon subscriptions. Or email podcast@ilampartners.com to become a sponsor or patron.